sci-fi show, Outcast. Welcome to Sci-Fi Show Outcast 62. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Today I have an interesting interview with Dr. Marvin Minsky. Marvin Minsky is a well-known AI researcher, and I think we had a pretty interesting conversation, so enjoy. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Marvin Minsky.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So first up, can you tell me a bit about yourself, what your background is, and who you are?
Oh, it's very hard to summarize, but when I was a little kid, I got interested in chemistry, and I read a couple of books because my father was a scientist, and there were all sorts of things to read, and chemistry was very much simpler in the early 20th century because it wasn't complicated by quantum theory. And anyway, I got interested in that, and then I got interested in mathematics and physics and all those sorts of things. And when I got to college, I sort of started to work on physics, and I discovered that there were a lot of physicists who were much better at that than I was. So then I sort of switched to mathematics, and I discovered that there were some people who were better than me at that, although I was pretty good. And then I got interested in psychology, and I discovered that there weren't very many people who were good at that at all. And so after a while, I moved from mathematics into the questions of how could a mind work and how could you build one. And I built various kinds of learning machines and so forth. And that's how I got where I am. If I saw a lot of people doing things and they were doing well, then that's fine. So I think I unconsciously searched for places where people weren't doing so well.
Okay. So I guess the first question is, what is a mind according to you, if indeed it's any one thing in particular?
Well, to me, the mind is the simplest definition, although I don't like definitions, is that minds are what brains do. And our brain has evolved to do a lot of things. If you look at a book about the brain, you'll find in the index at the end several hundred different parts of the brain, and then when you look them up, you find various speculations on what each of those parts do, and they seem to do rather different things. And so it seems to me that what happened since in the 400 million years since we were fish, there was 100 million years to evolve the first vertebrates, and then 100 million years of swimming around in the sea, and then 100 million years of amphibians and reptiles, and then gradually in the last 100 million years the mammals evolved, and in the last 5 or 6 million years we evolved. And I suspect that as the nervous system developed, we got a new way of reacting to situations and learning and so forth about every 100 million years. So my image is that if we want a good theory of psychology, we're going to need about 400 little theories and then a few very powerful higher-level theories about how all those things fit together.
Okay. Now, you've recently published a book called The Emotion Machine. What's that about?
The Emotion Machine is actually a sequel to a book I published about 20 years ago called The Society of Mind.
Oh, well, maybe we should start with what's The Society of Mind, then?
In The Society of Mind, my first book about this, I described a couple of hundred different mechanisms that seem to me going on when people think. And that's an interesting book because each chapter is one page long and describes one or another idea about some aspect of thinking, and not too much about how these are connected to each other. So the new book, The Emotion Machine, is sort of the opposite of that, and it starts from the top and asks questions about what happens when someone falls in love or gets a new theory or has to deal with a social or mathematical or whatever situation, and tries to make theories of how all the little parts of thinking fit together. And the main idea is that it's sort of negative in the sense that when you look at the way people think about the mind in common sense, everyday psychology, you see that they're always trying to divide things into pairs or opposites. So people talk about, well, the mind is a mixture of intellectual activities and emotional activities. So I call that a dumbbell theory. It's trying to split a huge, complicated thing into just two parts. And another dumbbell theory is that there is conscious thinking and unconscious thinking, or there's deliberate thinking and spontaneous thinking, or serial versus parallel, or holistic versus reductionist, and so forth. And if you look at everyday language, we have a lot of words that talk about thinking and minds and so forth, but they're usually in pairs, these sort of opposites. And it seems to me that nothing is ever that simple, and unless you can divide a particular phenomenon or activity into three or more aspects, you get stuck. Because if you have a pair of things that you think are opposite, then it's a sort of one-dimensional thing, and you can only go backwards and forwards, but you can't really get anywhere. So the book starts out by arguing that the distinction between emotions and thoughts is a very misleading one that has retarded psychology, and that what we call emotional states or emotional ways to think are just ways to think. And a good example is, for example, when someone gets angry. And usually people say, well, that's different from rational thinking. There we see the same old dumbbell of logical, rational thinking versus emotional or whatever. And it seems to me that a better way to look at it is to say that there isn't any such thing as either rational thinking or emotional thinking, but there are different ways to think, and each of them is made of a lot of sub-activities, so that, for example, when you're doing ordinary thinking, you're making analogies and you're dividing a problem into parts, and you're thinking of different ways to approach it and so forth. And you're engaging different sets of resources, mental resources. So, for example, if you look at a problem and it's too hard, one thing you can do is simplify it. It just takes some words out of the statement of the problem so it looks simpler. And, of course, then you're losing some details, but you can get a simple solution. And then you gradually put back the actual details of the problem you're facing, and that way that amounts to having divided into parts by simplifying it and then putting it back together. Now, consider when somebody is being angry. I regard that as a situation in which you've turned off most of your ordinary resources for solving problems, and you only turn on the ones that are faster. So you eliminate a lot of your social and diplomatic skills, and you don't look ahead so far at the consequences of each action, and you do things rapidly, and you get in a state where if you're attacked, you can defend yourself with a very short reaction time, because you're not thinking deeply or going down multiple paths and so forth. So most people think that, or it seems to me that most people think that emotions are adding features to ordinary thought, the way a painter would make a black and white sketch and then color it in, and they think of emotions as subtle additions. And as far as I can see, in most cases, it's just the opposite. When you're thinking more emotionally, you're actually turning off resources that you would ordinarily use and simplifying things.
Okay. Interesting idea. Now, You've been quoted as saying that there's the receding horizon effect and that this plagues philosophy and researchers in artificial intelligence. Could you explain what that is?
I guess I don't recognize that.
Oh, okay.
Related thing is this, that artificial intelligence really started about the same time as computers became available to scientists. And before that, there were analog machines, and at the end of World War II, there was a collection of theories that were called cybernetics, which were about how to build machines that reacted in useful ways to situations and used feedback to correct their errors and so forth. So in the 1940s, a lot of these theories developed about servo mechanisms and machines that appeared to work in a more purposeful and less mechanical way than previous machines. Well, when computers came around, it was now possible to make a machine that could do something more like symbolic reasoning or verbal reasoning or do logic and that sort of thing. And in the first few years, in the 1950s and early 1960s, all sorts of wonderful programs were written. And in our lab, for example, there was a program that was just about as good at doing first-year mathematical operations, algebra and calculus and things like that, using symbolic expressions. And these programs were very impressive because they were as good at these particular skills as good students were. And then a few years later, we tried to make these programs do more human-like activities, because the first ones could only solve algebra problems and things like that, where you're using mathematical symbols. But in high school, the students have to solve word problems, like John was 3 years older than Joe was when Joe was half John's age. And that's a language thing, and of course you can convert each phrase into an equation of some sort and then solve them. And we got some programs to do that. So then we tried to make programs that could understand a simple story from a first grade elementary school reading book, and we hit a wall. For example, there was a little story where Jack was invited to Mary's party. He wondered if she would like a new dress. Well, that's a strange pair of sentences, but everyone understands that. Why is he thinking about such a thing? Well, if you're invited to a party, you have to bring a present, and the present has to be something that's appropriate for the recipient and all sorts of questions like that. And it turned out that to understand very simple stories, you needed a vast amount of knowledge, whereas to understand specialized stories like hard problems in mathematics, you really only had to know a little bit, because the world of mathematics, or each little world of mathematics, depends on just 5 or 10 assumptions, whereas something about the real world depends on tens of thousands of little experiences that you've had. And here's what happened in artificial intelligence. Because we had been so successful at solving problems that people called hard with single methods, then when it came to the question of common sense or everyday or ordinary thinking, most researchers tried to do the same thing. So they would look for a physicist might call it a unified theory of thinking. And the field split into about 10 different areas, in each of which somebody said, I have an elegant theory of how to make a machine think. So some people said, let's do it by making a system that uses pure logic and makes a lot of assumptions and has the right kind of rules of inference. Another person would say, that's too strict. Let's make something that just collects statistics about experience and makes a big library of of probabilities that one thing will happen after another. And when you get enough of that database, then the machine will know what to do in each situation. And someone else would say, oh, that won't work because it'll take too long. Let's make a system that makes mutations in its program and tests to see how well it does on a bunch of problems. And that's called a genetic programming. So let's try to imitate evolution. But that didn't work very well either, although each of these methods did work for some problems. But most of them would slow down as the problems got harder or take longer and so forth. And so what I decided was that maybe that relates to why the brain has 400 little different computers in it all connected up in some kind of network. Namely, there are a lot of different kinds of problems and you need a different way to solve them. So now what's the big problem? My answer is some parts of the brain must be like literary critics or ordinary critics. Namely, they say, what kind of problem am I facing and what's a good method for solving that? So in this new book, The Emotion Machine, I talk about 10 or 20 different ways to think and how each of them might help to solve problems in some situation, but also how do we organize those so that some part of the brain at least knows which other methods to use. So you have a sort of management problem, and it seems to me that that's how we evolved, that we went through different environments and collected little pieces of brain that were good at climbing trees and good at social things and good at making new kinds of descriptions. And whenever you face a problem, I suspect that your brain describes it in 5 or 10 different ways in different parts of the brain. And then these critics, which are really the new part of the theory, get engaged to decide which way to represent this problem looks most promising. And then another critic will say, well, you've been doing that for 5 minutes and not making any progress, so you better switch to another method, and that sort of thing.
Okay. So what sort of research directions are you pursuing currently with the insights you've gained from this?
The book, which took actually 15 or 20 years to write, proposes a lot of machinery, and in recent years I've been trying to get students to write computer programs to do certain parts, and a few of these parts work on a few different kinds of problems. And also, one thing that we're doing and is also being done in 3 or 4 other places around the world is trying to collect millions of fragments of common sense knowledge and make databases of what every normal person knows. Common sense is very complicated, actually, because logic doesn't work very well because, I keep chaining these becauses, because all general rules have exceptions in real life. So, for example, if you had a story or if a child saw someone get an umbrella and you ask, why is he getting an umbrella? Why is he taking an umbrella? Then the child would say, well, he thinks it's going to rain. And you'd say, well, so what? And the child will say, well, he doesn't want to get wet. And you say, well, how will the umbrella help? And then a very articulate child would give you a nice scientific theory like the way water falls in the rain is mainly vertically downward. And so if you put a surface in between yourself and the sky, the water will hit the umbrella rather than the person, and it will slide off and fall around the edges. So every child, of 4 or 5 years old knows all that kind of qualitative physics also. And then you say, well, but why is he doing that? And the child will say, people don't want to get wet. And then you say, well, then how come they take showers and go swimming? And I actually haven't asked a lot of children that, but I imagine they would say, oh, well, that's an exception, or Who knows what they'd say? But no machine can do that yet, because almost all machines are either using statistical things and simply do the most likely thing without having a reason for it, except that the probability it will work is 0.79 or something, or they're using some kind of logic and it can't handle exceptions or whatever. And so what I'm trying now is to start a project of getting some really powerful programmers and cognitive architects, might be the right word, people who've been thinking about thinking for quite a while, and put these together into a machine that not only knows a lot of things, but it knows different ways to learn. And basically, as opposed to physics theories, where you're always looking for the simplest combination of, or the simplest explanation of something, our guiding rule is the opposite of that, the thing that philosophers call Occam's razor. Don't look for the best way. Look for the six pretty good ways that will work most of the time.
Okay. It sounds like fascinating research. It'll be interesting to see where that goes in the future.
In fact, people often say, well, will such a machine be conscious? And they talk as though consciousness is a very definite thing. And again, this approach answers, or at least to my satisfaction, a lot of questions that some philosophers think are very basic, like, is there a mental world, and does consciousness give you a connection between the physical and mental world, and what is subjective experience? And there are all those philosophical questions that people talk about a lot. And to me, a lot of those problems go away if you say, well, the word consciousness is just our name for about 20 different mental activities that we don't understand very well. So we shouldn't be looking for the way a physicist would. We shouldn't be looking for a unified theory of all those activities. I mean, when someone says, I was, or if you ask someone, were you conscious that you just touched your ear? The person will say, well, I don't remember doing that. So one meaning of conscious is, have you stored the thing in your short-term memory in a way that you can access it now? And another would be, have you represented it in some symbolic form, like a diagram or an image or a string of words? And another would be, Have you related what you did to some big complicated model of yourself in which you think of yourself as an object that has properties and processes and so forth? And so to me, some questions that people regard as very basic and elementary and important, like what is sensation or what is consciousness, are actually unanswerable because those words each refer to what I call a whole suitcase, a whole box of different questions. And so the question of what is consciousness is impossible to answer, but not because it's a single mysterious spiritual thing, but because that's a word we use to confuse 20, maybe or more different activities, and each of which may be pretty complicated, but at least you can start to explain them.
Okay. So one final question. If people wanted to learn more about your work, where's a good place to look?
Well, if you type Minsky to Google, you'll get my homepage, either the first or pretty soon. And then when you click on my homepage, there's actually a almost final draft of the Emotion Machine there, and 20 other essays. And so they're right there on the top of my homepage. And it's full of different articles about what are jokes and why do people like music and things like that. And if anyone is interested in those and has some questions, I think my email address is at the top of the page. And during the 20 years that I worked on this book, I talked by email and discussed these things with dozens or maybe a couple of hundred people all over the world who I've never met. And I've gotten a lot of very powerful suggestions and good ideas from this kind of interaction. course, I've had a lot of students here at MIT, and they've gone into much more detail on particular issues. But I think my homepage will point to a lot of things that people who are interested in psychology or philosophy might like.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today, Dr. Marvin Minsky.
Well, thank you very much, and it's been a pleasure talking to you and reading some of the items on your website.
Well, I hope everybody enjoyed that interview with Dr. Marvin Minsky, talking about his AI research and how the mind works, at least according to him. So, thanks for tuning in, everybody, and I hope you enjoyed it, and I'll talk to you next time. The Sci-Fi Show is copyright Jason Mooney, 2006. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative License, and the song Big Planet is used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great Nova Surfer tracks can be found at novasurfer.ml.